Welcome to the Good Money Habits podcast, where we marry financial education with tips from the experts on how to develop good money habits. Knowing what your options are around your finances is one thing, how to translate the knowledge into action for results is quite another. We're all about helping others take steps to gain financial stability, to live a better life. This podcast is brought to you by Lighthouse Capital. It is important to understand that today's episode is of general nature and doesn't take into account your personal objectives, financial situations, or needs, and may not be appropriate for you.
When we kicked off the Good Money Habits podcast during COVID all the way back in 2020, we talked about the three fundamentals of investing being inflation, diversification, and compounding. It seems like an awfully long time ago, but I do recall back then that inflation almost felt like an irrelevant concept to be talking about. Oh, how things have changed in the last few years. There's an awful lot going on in the world at the moment, which is why we've decided to jump back into the studio. We thought it might be helpful to talk through some of the things we're observing and seeing, and to just really be able to help you decipher it, see how the jigsaw puzzle fits together as best we can, and then look to give you some practical tips. So what is going on? I've touched on it already. We've got some meaningful inflation, the fastest interest rate rises we've actually ever seen. Layer onto that geopolitical tensions, Ukraine and Russia and China-US, both resulting in rapid changes to supply chains and increases in things like defence spending. Layer on that the decarbonisation of the world. So energy prices are ever rising. Meanwhile, we have ultra-low employment. Most people have a job out there. Then add to that the highest population growth numbers we've seen in Australia in decades, at a time when we've got the lowest rental vacancy rates and virtually no new supply of housing coming on stream. Where are these people going to live, and what does that mean for house prices and inflation? We've got ageing populations around the world, falling birth rates. I could go on and on and on. So given this backdrop, that was why we thought it was probably timely to get in here, have a chat about how we see these things fitting together and how they might play out. Now, I could think of no one better than my business partner and colleague, Michael Ipp, to help to try to make sense of it all. I finally got you here in the hot seat, Michael. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My absolute pleasure. And I just want to give the listeners a little bit of background, Michael, to your work history and where you've built up, I guess, your knowledge over the years. So Michael, actually, we were fortunate enough to have Michael join Lighthouse Capital back in October 2020, although we've been peers and connected for many, many years before that. Michael moved back to Perth with his young family from Sydney. He holds a Bachelor of Commerce, Accounting and Finance from the University of WA, the Diploma and Advanced Diploma of Financial Planning, and has completed the Graduate Diploma in Applied Finance and Investment. Michael has over 20 years' experience in the financial services industry in asset allocation, portfolio construction, and fundamental analysis within managed funds and listed equities. Most of that experience was gained in Sydney, where he held several senior positions in MLC 360 Research and JB Weir. In those roles, he contributed to asset allocation decisions, macroeconomic analysis, and investment research analysis for high net worth businesses and clients. Today, Michael chairs our investment committee and oversees the asset allocation, governance, and investment decisions for Lighthouse Capital, and is the director and head of research and investments. Michael is really passionate about what he does and takes the responsibility in looking after clients' money very seriously. Outside of work, his next passion is his family. His two little monkeys, I actually got to see them this morning when they got in from swimming, which was super cute, which keep Michael alert, active and patient, which he reminds us are all key characteristics for all investment professionals. Ask him if he wants another child, and he'll often say he's far too busy looking after investment portfolios. So to paint the picture for you, Michael and I sit, I'm going to say roughly 2 metres apart.
And closer.
A little bit closer. And it's interesting on a daily basis, I think, for our team. We're in an open plan office that we often have some pretty interesting conversations and debates and share information about what we're observing. But something that does amuse me from time to time is that often we'll just say one word, won't we, Mike? And no more needs to be said. We know exactly what the other one's referring to.
Yeah, correct.
We have a little bit of fun with that. So on that, I know lately you've been talking quite a bit around the new world of investing. Would you mind sharing with the listeners what you mean by that and why it's important?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I talk about the new world, but in fact, the older generations will realize we've been here before. Why I say that, you know, if we look at it now, it's been pretty much a decade of low interest rate environment. Well, if I look at Australia started reducing their interest rate from, you know, a mere 4.75% back in October 2021.
Not far from where we are now. 2011.
2011, sorry about that. To where it got to, let's say, 0% to around April 2022. Okay. So Australia had over a decade of falling rates and falling costs of capital, as I turn it, and cost of money. So money was free for everyone for over 10 years. So, you know, it wasn't too hard to actually try to make some money when, you know, risk-free rates were virtually zero.
So, in other words, it was very cheap to be able to borrow.
Very cheap to borrow, very cheap to take on additional risk. Mm-hmm. You know, so that eventuated for, you know, many, many years, you know, and unless you're got more experience or more white hair, you don't realise what has happened over time. Mm. You know, and right now, if I look at it, assets now need to work harder. Investors would need to rebase their expectations and time frame. As term deposit, if I look at it, is around 5% now. It's a much harder hurdle when you've got, you know, no risk investment at 5%. Mm. Do I need to take on that additional risk when I can get 5% return?
That is such an important point. And I'm sure for the listeners, particularly, you know, retirees who we work with on a daily basis, you know, up until recently, they got nothing off a term deposit. But as you say, if you know you can pretty much get 5% virtually risk-free, as we call it, you're going to get that return and your capital won't effectively be at risk. Then if you're going to deploy money and invest it, then you'd have to be pretty confident of getting a return above that hurdle.
Yeah.
To make it worthwhile.
No, exactly. And it becomes a much harder hurdle. And then at the same time, to take on that additional risk, you know, everything costs more, you know, is something that we as investors or asset allocators, we have to be mindful of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the easy way of trying to buy any assets the last 10 years. It's virtually gone now. We need to reconsider what it all means when money is worth something to everyone now.
Exactly. So on that note, then why are we in this new world? What's been the trigger or created this scenario?
Well, really, it's the central banks and governments, you know, they partially caused this new world, if I really think about it. Because in hindsight, you know, the world had too much stimulus, both from the government and central banks.
We certainly saw that in COVID, didn't we? And record savings levels around the world, not evenly spread, but certainly in some pockets, really high savings levels accumulated.
Correct. I mean, looking back in hindsight, I think most of the global banks will now say they wouldn't have repeated what they did. But it's great in hindsight. You know, looking back in COVID, the world was supposed to end. Mm-hmm. And all the central banks around the world did everything they could to ensure that nothing collapsed.
Ensure that safety net, but they didn't know how deep or long the ditch was in front of them.
Correct, because as human nature, we just tend to be more pessimistic. we tend to be more fearful. So we tend to put in more guarantee, you know, assurances so that we can sleep better at nights, you know. And looking back now, and, you know, this has led to what I would like to now lead us into, the discussion as global inflation.
And do you think then, you know, not long after the COVID pandemic, we then saw the first hot war in Europe with Ukraine and Russia and an oil breakout? I mean, surely that was not the best timing, given the foundations that had been laid with all that sort of stimulus already in the system.
Yeah, it was like, looking back, it's like the perfect storm. You know, if I look about COVID, you know, around 2020, you know, March, give or take a bit, 2020, then we were coming out of that pandemic level, that fear level. The issue then, we had the Ukraine war, you know, just as when we were, things were going to stabilize again and things were looking a bit better, you know, we had a bomb that's just exploded on the left field, and that just caused everything to rebase, you know, the demand side to change, the supply issues started to eventuate. And then what we saw was that energy prices, oil prices, you know, rallied really hard. And, you know, the central banks was then trying to work out, well, what did all that mean again? What could they do? Government had to re-look at their, you know, policies. You know, before, everyone's were best friends. They all talk about, why don't we get China or get Russia or get other countries to produce some goods? Because it was the most effective or cost-effective way of outsourcing the capital. But when there's a war, everyone started to close their borders and realized that the protectionism that we tried so many decades to get rid of came back within 6 to 12 months.
So the deglobalisation that we really saw, I guess, starting the really early 2000s when China joined the WTO, saw labour markets open up and really saw globalisation become quite a strong deflationary force, one would argue, wouldn't you? Whereas now that's flipped on its head and we've got the reverse, where we've almost, as you said, that protectionism, friendshoring, people are wanting more diversification in their supply chains, that kind of thing, to stop finding themselves in a scenario where you get a pandemic and they can't get, you know, the widget out of whatever country they're manufacturing it in to sell at a time when demand's the greatest. So it's been an interesting period, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. All these factors has caused what I term as an inflation problem now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, all these factors, the war, deglobalization, the pandemic, and free money from the government and from central banks has caused this perfect storm of inflation. And if we recall, you know, 12 months ago, we never thought inflation would have risen as quick as it did. And now we're at the back end of it, in the sense that it's not coming down as quick as everyone expected. Or as hoped, you know, and that's an issue.
And I think for central banks as well, you know, they're really having to dust off the history books, aren't they? Because you have to look quite some time back in history to another period of time where there was this kind of environment. And if I'm correct, that was, you know, the late 70s and early 80s. So it was quite some time ago. What does this mean for investors?
What I would term as the market has forgotten, you know, history, what has happened, you mentioned before. You know, we've come to a situation, we had inflation issue before. How it gets tackled, we use a pretty blunt instrument, which is the money policy of central banks, interest rates.
I'm glad you've raised that, because I think that's a really important point for the listeners to take away, because something that I think people might be wondering is, over the last 20 years prior to this period, when we got into trouble, if things got bumpy during the GFC or COVID we've mentioned, or the Ukraine war, we saw that stimulus. We saw the governments come in and central banks come in and rescue. It's not happening this time around. And it seems that we only really have this one tool, right, which is monetary policy, interest rates, and it is blunt. Can you explain why it's blunt?
Well, interest rates affects everyone, you know, whether you're, you know, rich or poor, whether you have a mortgage or don't have a mortgage, it affects everyone. You know, unfortunately, higher interest rates disproportionately affects low-income earners.
And mortgages.
Mortgages, especially in Australia, where the vast majority of our mortgages are on variable rates. Right.
As opposed to the US, and might be of interest for the listeners to know, because not everyone is aware of this, is that in America, when you take out a home loan, your rate's actually fixed for the term of the loan, 30 years. It doesn't actually alter. So they're not feeling, households that have already got a mortgage, they're not feeling this to the same degree that Australians are, right?
No, exactly. So partially that's why, if I look at, you know, our official interest rate is currently at around 4.1%.
Mm-hmm.
US is around 5.25 to 5.5.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference. When you got 100 basis or 1% difference, it's because majority of our debt available.
Mm-hmm.
Every time the RBA increase rates, it affects us a lot more, mm-hmm. affects the Australian consumers a lot more, because more of our money goes back into the mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I look at, everyone gets affected differently. You know, we've got an aging population. We read about it, we hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
In effect, that shows it's a different environment than what it was back in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The aging population are the ones that are least amount of people have mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the one that tends to benefit from these high interest rates.
Mm.
So grandparents are a great source of presence for my kids now, mm-hmm. you know. So therefore, everything's being pushed out. Everything's been changed.
Mm.
The history doesn't always repeat itself exactly the same.
No, correct.
But there's similarities. And that's where we hopefully can get some guidance to how things gets tackled. You know, right now the central banks are, you know, juggling a situation where rates has increased the highest, you know, most aggressive, the quickest it has increased in history.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they are all hoping to start dropping the rates, start reducing the interest rates.
Mm.
And markets tend to be, you've heard it, forward-looking.
Mm-hmm.
But when the forward-looking scenario doesn't eventuate, that's when you see markets get some volatility.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen it. If I looked at earlier this year, the market was thinking, oh, you know, interest has gone up so quick, so high. We talked about the mortgage cliff. We talked about, you know, the consumers is going to suffer from all these potential bad debts and all that. It hasn't eventuated.
Mm.
You know, it hasn't eventuated. I mean, early this year, because of what they were thinking of, what was considered as a hard landing,
mm.
they were all thinking, okay, rates going to go back down by this year, by November this year.
And as you said earlier, because it's such a blunt instrument, for some people listening, they'll be thinking, that's all good and well, but I'm really hurting here. Whereas others might be thinking just that, we're actually managing okay and we're getting through okay. And I know in speaking to quite a lot of clients, they like to remind me that from their perspective, they really view this as more a normal interest rate setting. So what we had previously was more an emergency setting and abnormal, you know, with a 1.99% mortgage rate. But just on that, for those people who are really feeling the pinch, you're not on your own. There are many people in that position, and I do have Michelle Taylor in the studio here as well, who I'll be chatting to next around some advice and tips on how, you know, things you might be able to do to try and get things back under control again. But Mike, I know that we don't have a crystal ball, and we don't know for sure. It's going to be data dependent, but your gut feel, I think the listeners, you know, the $1 million question is, are we close to the top? Is there more to come? What's your views?
My view, to be brutally honest, I believe we are pretty much there. You know, we are more there than what we were, even if I look at it 6 months ago. Okay, so the question is, if we're almost there, is interest rates go higher? Okay, well, my view, it's not necessary, you know. So, I mean, if I look at the interest rate cycle, it's been the most aggressive. The key question that we should start considering and start asking is, when do I believe, or when can we start to see interest rate to come down?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because interest rates were going up purely as a tool to fight inflation. Okay, how to fight inflation is to reduce demand, reduce economic growth, and reduce consumer spending.
Mm-hmm.
We are starting to see that already.
The impact of it.
Impact. I mean, yesterday we got retail sales. It was a slight down compared to consensus.
Mm.
But if I look at year on year, the consumer spending year on year, end of August, was only 1.3%. It looks like, wow, you know, 1.3, that's not bad. You know, when interest rates is at 4.1%, mortgages is at around 6%. But don't forget, you just mentioned we've had one of the most biggest population growth. And even with the population growth, I'm only getting a 1.3% increase in retail sales.
Mm.
It means that we are tightening our belt.
Yes.
And that's where we are seeing inflation starting to come down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We are seeing that. But then now we've got energy prices, back to what it was back in November last year,
mm.
you know, around $96 a gallon mm-hmm. per barrel. You know, that's going to cause inflation to remain high for longer.
For longer.
And that's my issue.
And if we zoom out a little bit, I guess, and think beyond 1, 2, 3 years and more longer term, some of the structural things we've touched on, so deglobalisation, right at the beginning, decarbonisation of the world, or, you know, going green, if you like, the trend where we're seeing countries around the world building up sovereign reserves, you know, food security, energy security, commodities and so on. What's your sort of view longer term? Do you see that where we are now, you know, could be more sustained than what people have been thinking?
That's an interesting question. Yeah. I mean, my biggest fear is that the market is not factoring that interest rates going to be higher for longer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the sustainability of everything has got to do with consumer confidence, consumer spending and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is just waiting for indication that rates is going to come down. One fact that I'm looking back in history, it illustrates to me is that previous rate increase cycles and when rates start to go down, I don't always need a total collapse. I don't always need a recession.
Mm-hmm. That's the soft landing they're referring to.
Correct.
In the media.
Yeah, exactly. And then soft landing is good. It means that the unemployment doesn't hit double digits. It means that, you know, the bad debts doesn't increase to, you know, extreme levels back in the 80s
mm-hmm.
or during the global financial crisis. So all those are good things. But if we do get a soft landing, the other side of it is that it means the interest rates won't need to fall as quick.
Yes.
The reason why it won't need to fall as quick is that the markets need to be careful that we don't repeat ourselves back in the 70s and 80s when we first saw the central banks dropping rates too quick, too soon.
Mm-hmm.
When inflation was not fully tamed.
And you saw that second leg and that breakout and our parents got those 17, 18% interest rates.
Exactly.
Mm.
Market don't like uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get a second leg, the market gets confused and get fearful
mm-hmm.
and don't know where we're heading.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we are heading in an environment where we just have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
I see the central banks are doing as good a job as they can.
Mm-hmm.
They are trying not to lead us into thinking what the future will be, and hence they talk about being data dependent.
Yes, exactly. So let's see what the data produces. So, Mike, I wouldn't mind your views on the Australian banking system. So just changing tack a little bit. So thinking about the fact that we've seen the collapse of some US banks, certainly a European bank with Credit Suisse. I think, you know, I always have the sense that the stability of the banking system is like the ballast in the keel in our economy. What's your views on that?
Yeah, it's a really important point. That's why I say, you know, history tends to repeat itself, but you repeat yourself differently. Why I say that differently, our banking system is totally different than what it was during the global financial crisis or even during the 1980s when we were in a similar situation of high bond yields, high inflation, high interest rates. Why it's different is because our banking system really learned the lessons during the global financial crisis, not just in Australia, but globally.
Mm-hmm.
So if I just use in Australia point of view, if I look at CBA's capital level, the capital that protects their deposit holders and to protect the bank for higher debt, that was only around 5%
mm-hmm.
back in 2007. If I look at CBA capital level today, they're around 12%.
More than double.
It's more than double. And the regulators are telling them they need to be more than double. You know, the regulators' benchmark is over 10%.
Mm.
But you never cut a too fine line. So the banks tend to have a buffer above that as well. So we're in a different environment. And it's important that our banks are strong right now. When interest rates high, the talk about bad debts coming in back into the equation, economy slowing down, we are in a much better position, and hence a soft landing is a possibility.
Mm.
But the issue with a soft landing is, as I said before, interest rate could stay high
for longer.
Might not be so bad. It's just that you have to be more mindful of it. And yeah. I don't believe the governments and central banks will automatically come and save the equity markets if we get a 10% correction.
Well, at the end of the day, the system's running too hot with inflation, so they can't. That's fundamentally the difference, isn't it?
Correct.
So thinking about the US banking problems, I think it's probably worth sharing, not to get too technical, but the fundamental issue there was around hedging out the interest rate risk. As interest rates started rapidly rising, their banking system was exposed to that. We don't have that risk in Australia, do we?
No, the regulators force our banks to hedge their interest rate positions. But then this is a perfect example. If you don't have the ability and understand that duration side of a bond interest rate, I mean, let's talk about fixed income quickly.
Yes.
You know, let's assume one of the biggest issues about fixed income is that you're lending money to companies. Let's assume the companies is secure and safe. You will get your money back. But if I look at 12 months ago when the 10-year government bond was around 0.5%. Right now, I can buy that same bond 12 months' time, same government, at around 4.6%.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
So what does that mean? You as an investor, would you go and buy and keep that bond at 0.5% for the next 10 years? Or you buy a new bond at 4.5%?
So the value of the bond at 0.5% is worth a lot less than the one that's going to pay you a higher rate of return.
Yeah.
Which is why I think a lot of people got caught off guard in 2022 when people think about, so just touching on asset allocation, and I did want to cover that off with you as well and your views on the importance of that, but people think about bonds and fixed income as being the defensive part of their portfolio, but it was because of the speed and the rapid change in that interest rate environment that actually saw, you're referring to the duration, for those that were locked in those lower rates, they really took a capital hit.
In that
part of their portfolio.
Correct. I mean, for us, for investors and asset allocators, you always have to be mindful. Right now, I believe we're in an environment that we shouldn't take drastic bets because we're not at extremely high levels of interest rates. Unlike when interest rates were zero, it was
quite extreme to the low side.
Low side.
Mm-hmm.
So logically, when you're looking back, is why will I go and lock myself away for 10 years? zero interest rate.
And this is not advice, incidentally, by the way. This is just more general information and observations. But I think it's a really important concept to share and for people to think about.
Yeah.
Can you talk about asset allocation and the importance of that in portfolio construction in this new world of investing?
A lot more choices now. You know, well, before, as asset allocators, I didn't have to think about cash so much as a potential return mechanism.
Mm.
I didn't have to think about government bonds or corporate bonds as much when they're paying around 5% now, because the only way I could get 5% back then was to invest in assets or companies that were paying dividends at 4 or 5%, you know. But then now when cash is worth something again now, we asset allocators have to be more mindful. We've got more choices. We need to actually be more diversified, you know, and we need to consider the quality of the actual assets we're buying.
I hear you talk quality all day long in the office. Can you explain, I guess, in simple terms, what does that mean? What are you looking for with quality?
Yeah. For me, quality is where management is reliable, stable. At the same time, a company, whether you're looking on the debt side or whether you're looking at buying, you know, shares on the equity side, that they have the balance sheet to survive whatever the interest rate may be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if their balance sheet is strong, if their debt level is low, the interest rate cycle, how it moves over 12 months or 2 years, to me it becomes irrelevant, because over time that company will continue to grow their revenue, able to pay its debt, which means they will be able to continue paying their bondholders, you know. And then at the same time, I look at the what products they're producing. Is it quality property? Is it something that I understand that the actual product they are producing is quality? Is something that I will actually buy myself?
Mm.
You know, do we understand it? Or is it just something up in the air where we don't know? You know, it's a good feel, but we can't see it's going to be lasting for the next 3 or 5 years, and do they have competitive edge? Can someone set up a shop in their garage and take market share overnight? That's important to consider.
No, love it. That's a brilliant explanation. Just to round it off, reading between the lines, there obviously is a lot of uncertainty, higher levels of volatility over the last few years than we've seen in a while. Do you see this as a typical occurrence for a normal and healthy functioning market?
Yes, I believe so. Because when markets are in extreme situations, we tend to forget what happens. We tend to take everything too easily. When interest rates, like for example, when interest rates were zero, you forget that, you know, investing, there's risk involved.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be careful where you allocate your money.
Mm.
So right now, when there's an environment of high uncertainty, whether it's geopolitical, you know, are we going to get a recession? If so, how long, how severe, how deep?
Mm.
Is interest rate going higher or going lower? And if it's going lower, when? You don't want to take extreme positioning. You don't want to bet your house to a certain position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so having a balanced approach, having quality assets, having multiple, your capital working multiple markets, and having a quality bias to your portfolio is pure. It makes sense right now, more so than, you know, if I look at it, what it was in an environment when interest rates were low. That's an environment I don't see us repeating, unfortunately. And then, you know, it's a conversation that I often have with the older generations and with my parents. There's a lot to learn, because what they've learned during the, you know, 1780s, we are looking at this situation again, but how we fight it and how we tackle it is going to be different.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And Mike, I've decided that I think your favourite thing in the world is quality. Mine's compounding. So
compounding.
You get sick of me banging on about that, don't you?
No, but I love it. Compounding is great, whether you've got, an investor or mortgage holder. It works wonderfully.
Is it your friend or your foe? There's two sides to that coin, isn't there? Mike, thank you so much. As usual, I mean, it's like literally sitting in the office having our usual chat and banter. I really hope that's been helpful to the listeners to hopefully unpick and unravel a little bit around what's going on, how things are connected, things to consider, and then to determine and think about, well, what does that mean? Where to from here? So we might round it out there. I've got Michelle here ready to go, another business partner and good friend of mine. And we're going to have a chat around accepting this new world. What are some of the things we should be thinking about at a practical level? What are some things that you can do to get ahead of the curve and just get a bit more stability and control back in your life? So, Mike, thank you once again. Cannot thank you enough.
No, thank you.
That was another episode of Good Money Habits, brought to you by Lighthouse Capital. A reminder that this episode was general in nature and doesn't take into account your personal objectives, financial situation, or needs, and therefore may not be appropriate for you. It is recommended that you seek professional advice before making any significant financial decisions. If you want to find out more, this podcast is available on Apple Podcasts or head to www.lighthousecapital.com.au.